Broadcasting live today at Norwich University, we're here at the Sullivan Museum and History Center. Coming up tomorrow is the public session, 1 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. The topic, cyber warfare and privacy. How do we keep the balance between rights of citizens and the security of the nation? 1 to 3 p.m., and that is at the Plumlee Armory. Let's give a nice warm Radio Vermont welcome this morning to Ed Tracy. Ed was one of the founders here of the Colby Military Writers Symposium some 20 years ago, and you don't look a day older.
Thank you very much, Mark. It's great to be back.
Well, I wasn't here 20 years ago. So
I know you were just a babe at that time.
I think maybe I was in college or something still.
No, you were broadcasting.
Yeah, I was.
You were broadcasting in Vermont, yep. And...
I just hadn't been invited yet. You know, it was like, I guess I had to get more seasoned in order to get invited.
Well, in those days, you know, radio still is very big. You know, radio was the only thing happening in 9/11. It was for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
You could only tune into the radio. So radio will never go away. And we knew how important it was to have WDEV as a partner. And they used to do the morning run-ups, those 10-minute Eric Michael segments a week before the symposium. The authors would call in and they'd talk. And then they'd come and we'd do the live interviews here. And I guess we're doing it at the station, or we phoned them in.
Yeah.
We didn't do them online.
Kind of phoned it in, as they say.
Phoned it in from Northfield Inn. But it was kind of exciting. We were on campus and everyone was back, and there was general excitement to have all these people there. And the radio station was very good to help promote us, of course. And we were doing hockey with you at that time, too.
So what do you think of your baby here at the age of 20?
Well, you know, all things considered, Norwich has come an incredibly long way in the last 25 and 30 years. It's been an amazing journey to watch how Norwich has grown and how the campus has thrived, and the merging of the campus with civilian and core. And the Colby Symposium was one of those elements outside of the building program, outside of the academic and admissions program, that would kind of be an extra to people, kind of was bringing these experts to campus to make people think and socialize with them.
Yeah.
And all these years later, it's still a viable, great program for that. You know, it's important to have other points of view outside of the faculty and to have an opportunity to stop and kind of look at the future of what these students will be dealing with, how the social aspect will impact them. And, you know, we started out putting together journalists and filmmakers and writers, historians, fiction writers together, kind of all in one pot to give a different point of view to whatever the current topic was. But 9/11 changed that. 9/11... all of a sudden, it's the game has been elevated. The dial's turned up, and for the last 14 years or so, the Colby has served as a platform to talk about those issues that really impact the students,
mm-hmm.
by people who have really been there and are writing about it. And mixed in that, like the York book, which is a great book, by the way, lessons from history, historic. Heroic lessons from history, and really fascinated by the York story because of all the time I spent telling the Medal of Honor stories out in Chicago.
Right, yep. You know, one of the things that's always fascinated me about this, first year I came down here, I thought it was just going to be all rah-rah military. And really what, you know, Ed, what I've found over the years is that what's the voices that have been invited here are ones that really challenge this whole idea of warfare and really make the point that it's the least attractive alternative. And I think that's really, I think that's important.
Yeah. Well, our armed services are not trained. They're trained to fight. They're trained to win. But they're also trained to build and to keep the peace. And what you find from the writers, especially during the Iraq and Afghanistan period that you were covering all those years, is that there weren't any real great answers. I mean, every week there was more questions. And a lot of people came to the library at that time out in Chicago, and we would have one point of view one week and another completely contrary point of view the next week of how to resolve all that. Mm-hmm. And it really mirrors the society that we live in. I mean, we live in a very fractured society. There's very polar points of view. And the military is squarely in those polar points of view. I mean, are we supposed to be serving? Are we supposed to be out being the international police cop? And what are the realities of that versus, you know, we have problems at home. How do we deal with all of those problems at home? So the Colby, I think, brings controversial thinking and expands. I just spoke to a class in communications, and I asked everybody where they got their news from, and you probably wouldn't be surprised to hear where a lot of them got their news from.
But it was Facebook, only where did
Fox.
They get it? Fox.
Yeah,
okay.
One right. On television, okay. I guess I was surprised. I wasn't surprised that would be one aspect of it, but it was pretty much the primary aspect of their news gathering. You know, and with the technology today, I mean, you can have resident apps that drop headlines from every major newspaper in the world into your box if you really wanted to be that much of a generalist. And I really feel that I've kind of evolved into a generalist, that I have lots of interests, lots of social interests in terms of health thing we were talking about earlier, cancer and post-traumatic stress, but also just general news, which I think requires you to have a broad understanding of what's going on. And I always felt the Colby was that kind of a place. I felt that somebody should come in here and introduce a completely new and fresh thought, and the students should gnaw on it for a while. And hopefully they'll think about it after everyone's gone.
Who is at the first Colby?
First Colby had W.B. Griffin and Carlo d'Este, who kind of around whom we founded it. The first person we called was Bill Colby, and we asked him to be kind of the anchor. He asked why, and I said, well, we wanted a statesman kind of.
Very suspicious.
Well, yeah, why would I be there with a fiction writer and a historian? I mean, you know, it was kind of an odd grouping, you know, because typically he would talk about international affairs. I mean, he was the keynote speaker of things. I said, well, we're trying to create a group that will look at issues from all around. And the first program we talked about was the heroic myth. And so we had those three, and then we really needed someone to kind of balance Colby once we had Colby here. So we invited Phil Caputo, who was tremendous and not known to the UVM Norwich campus, except for The Rumor of War and the Walt Levy reference, but never had been here, not much of the culture. Harry Coyle and Cole Kingseed, who was kind of, he'd written one book on Eisenhower and Suez, but he was a career Army officer and also, you know, a budding historian. He's become quite a historian at this point, I should say, budding at that time. It was 20 years ago.
Right.
But
right.
He was, of all of the people, he had written only one book at that point. And so we had the group in the Plumley Armory. We rented furniture from a furniture store from Barry and had a nice living room kind of set. And we set up video and videotaped all the three sessions. They're all held in Plumley. Very sparse crowd. But a lot of the same people that are here this week were at the first one and have been to every one since. The conversation was really intense. I mean, that heroic myth piece, which I actually have the DVD right there for you. I was going to give you a copy of it, the CD. It's centered on a introductory piece by Caputo, who kind of talked about the futility of what he did in Vietnam, the futility of following commands that would ultimately lead to death or other problems with his company, and realizing that within a day or two the enemy would retake that position and they'd be going and doing it all over again.
So it was Hamburger Hill,
fruitlessness of that. Well, he wasn't in Hamburger Hill, but it's that idea.
Yeah.
And that balanced Colby's point of view, which basically was that he never really questioned. He questioned what we did there, he said, but he never questioned why we were there. And that was a quote that always stuck with me from that session, is that Bill Colby was somebody who believed in in our ability to change things.
Right.
And he also believed that you had to operate within the laws of the land that you were working with. I mean, you couldn't be corrupt yourself, too, because then it brought you down to that level. But he predicted, rightfully predicted, that we would be dealing with terrorist forces and tribes and these kinds of things that we're dealing with right now, but certainly 9/11. He predicted that in 1996. And he said people are working on it every day. And we found out, of course, in the course of future programs, we talked to more people who were associated with him and with Sally Colby. And we just have no concept as to what our government is doing daily to stop these forces all the time. I mean, we do see the ones that don't get stopped, mm-hmm. and we see things that happen. But it's a constant challenge, constant vigil. And Bill Colby was one of the people that did that very well for a long time.
We're talking with Ed Tracy, one of the founders of the Colby Military Writers Symposium. You can join us at 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255. What do you think the value has been to people outside of Norwich?
The Colby Symposium's got a national reputation as a place to come and talk to students. It's held at the center of the oldest private military school in the country. This is quite a historic, unbelievably beautiful place. And I have always been really proud that Norwich was associated with something that was scholarly and also had had an edge to it a little bit. You know, from time to time, we were perceived, you know, when I was working here for 13 years, we were perceived as a little traditional, you know, a little conservative. You know, it's the military. But that doesn't mean that you're geographically remote when it comes to talking about these topics.
Other ideas.
And so to bring people here and to kind of expand that knowledge and to understand that it's an opportunity for everyone in the state of Vermont to come. I mean, this public session that occurs at Plumlee Armory is free and open to the public all over the state. And I was always a huge advocate of that for television purposes, radio, whatever. I said, come and listen. Come, spend the hour and a half. Your life will be changed. You'll be able to see these students asking these questions. You'll see this discussion, debate. And so I think that's how it helped Norwich understand that there's other aspects to our educational program that we can provide for the community. Now, in the last 10 years or so, with the Todd Lecture Series and some of the other expansions that have happened, the beautiful Sullivan Library we're sitting in, and some of these places, I can't be more proud of Norwich and my hometown and what they have done to elevate this campus. I mean, it is absolutely beautiful.
Well, this facility here, I mean, it's just, you know, top shelf. Yeah. Really is something else.
And they got one of the best broadcasters in New England doing this program today. So,
is there another show around the corner here or something? Huh. Let me have you put those on. We'll take a phone call from Burlington. And I apologize. I kept you waiting too long. Give us a jingle back. 244-1777. Toll-free 877-291-8255. You mentioned cancer. You are a cancer survivor. What is this connection that you draw between surviving cancer and post-traumatic stress from serving? Is that where you're going?
Well, I spent the last 10 years, or the 10 years after I left Norwich, working to build the programming at the Pritzker Military Library. And I was developing these interviews with combat veterans and with Medal of Honor recipients.
Mm-hmm.
And I found a connection between the combat stress of Medal of Honor recipients and their action and the kind of the life story that they were telling after that action. And then in 2008, things were going along really well in my life. I have to say that it was one of the more important times. Things were just all clicking, and cancer can really put you in a new mindset.
Uh-huh.
Right away. And I had just come back from a reunion of my high school class here, and it had been a very effective, wonderful thing. And I was diagnosed, and Facebook was just starting, and everyone moved on to Facebook, and I did not move with everyone. I decided that I would not be one of those people to live my health issues out on Facebook. And I have to tell you, it was a good choice, because what you read about cancer, if you're confronted with it, you immediately go to the internet and try to become an expert.
Right, internet doctor. Yeah.
And everything on the internet is 7 years old. There's nothing that will help you with your cancer today. And also, it's very generalist.
Yeah.
Too. It is. It's for the perfect person who's in perfect shape, and which I was not. And they have a different cancer than I have, blah, blah, blah. So I went to my doctor and I said, who do I listen to? And he said, you listen to me. And I'll tell you what you need to do, because I know your weight and I know what's wrong with you, and we'll get you better. And so I decided that I would write at certain times during my treatment and kind of reflect on it. In the background. But when I was healthy, I didn't want to be spending a lot of time telling people how I was doing or what I was doing. And I want to just focus on work and keep moving forward. Well, that's how people with combat stress deal with combat stress. They keep putting things in front of their problem.
Working harder.
And if it starts to get them, they work harder than they did before. And at some point in time, there's a payback. I mean, you just can't work through your life that way. You really need to stop at certain intervals, take an assessment, and do that. So there was a big buildup in my life, and I had to deal with that, and I was very happy to deal with that. And I've been involved in a project for a year and a half. I do project management work now, and we just completed a book, a memoir of Vietnam called Fearful Odds. It was just sent from the printer actually yesterday. And it is about the combat event in this veteran's life in 1968 on Hamburger Hill, but before the battle. And then the events that occur afterwards during a very successful life that happened 40 years afterwards, and how he dealt with all of that through counseling and through stress management and medication and a bunch of other things. It's a fascinating project. But working through that project, I realized that there are several levels of dealing with post-traumatic stress that we all have to understand. We have to understand about the immediate, compound effect of a returning veteran now. And then this time bomb is sort of out there. Mm-hmm. I mean, things will happen as you age.
Right.
And I felt that if we could understand where those warning signs are along the way, mm-hmm. we might help people cope with it a little better than this guy did, kind of never seeing the wave coming.
Did you ever have, on that back end, did you have sort of whatever it is, the unraveling, the blow up, whatever you're talking about here, that can build up to?
Well, I think I had several symptoms myself personally. I had a different regime of cancer therapy, and one of those drugs provided was right on the front end of stopping any kind of nausea during chemotherapy treatment.
Okay.
But one of the byproducts of that is neuropathy. So if you take too much of this drug, and I can't remember the name of it but right now, but you could venture into this
nerve pain
thing.
Yeah.
And I had very painful neuropathy in my hands and feet for a very long time, to the point where, and I went right back to work. I mean, I was doing a weekly television show,
right,
40 times a year in Chicago, and my my surgery and treatment was in between the summer when we were on hiatus, and my chemotherapy lasted for 6 months during the fall season. So I was wearing a little bag for 3 days while I was interviewing Medal of Honor recipients or other people on the television. So I could not write my scripts. I had to use dragon speech, max speech, which I became very good
yeah,
at.
I'll bet you did.
I went through really extensive massage therapy, and on one particular day, these nerves all came back in my hands. It was really amazing. And but I had tremendous support from the organization out there, and was still working, you know, long days and long nights. I mean, you know, chemotherapy, it gives you a lot of pep for a week or so, and then there's a downtime, and once you understand what your body is doing, you can yeah. isolate those times. So I worked it out so that my downtimes were the weekends. Mm-hmm. People never really saw that part, but people knew something was happening. I mean, I was overweight and lost a lot of weight and started to look pretty good, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Which the doctor predicted. I said I would not recommend that as a
weight diet.
Therapy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
but And you know, all of those things, I think your whole chemistry changes for a long time. I mean, I was sweating a lot, and, you know, it's, I still can't go into loud bars and things. Loud places are really kind of, they kind of screw up my wiring a little bit.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's probably because we're 60, and that's what that's all about.
Well, speak for yourself. You got a few years out of me, my friend. Thank you for joining us, and good luck. Good luck in the next couple of days, sir.
Thanks.
I'm sure everybody's really happy to see you back.
It's been great to be in my hometown, and I really love what's happened here, and appreciate the support you've given the program.
Well, it's one of my favorite shows every year, so great. I appreciate your help too.
Great.
And it was I have to tell folks, I had that one of the fun times that I had was that a couple of days broadcasting out in Chicago at Pritzker. That was a blast.
Yeah.
We'll take a short break. Coming up next, we're going to talk about cybersecurity. We're broadcasting live today at the Colby Military Writers Symposium. We are here on the grounds of Norwich University. Let me remind you about our good friends up in Middlesex at the Middle Ground at the Mud Studio, a place where you can get one-of-a-kind unique gifts for those people, you know, those people that have everything. And you say, oh, well, you know, what could I possibly get them? Well, head on over and see our friends at the Mud Studio. Here's why. There is a group of a couple of dozen Vermont artists who do their work out of that facility. So they present their wares for you to purchase. And really, I bought a couple for Christmas. They were just absolutely beautiful. So I encourage you to head on there for any and all special occasions. Maybe you have a friend with a birthday coming up. Maybe somebody's celebrating an anniversary. Maybe somebody just had a new addition to the family. You could get them a nice gift at the Mud Studio. So check it out. It's right down at the Middle Ground. It's right next door to our friends at Red Hen Cafe and Bakery, right in front of the folks at the Middle Ground Florist. And if you're an artist, you might want to consider renting some space there, because they you could have that collaborative effect, you know, the one-on-one equals three effect. You know, you hang out with really smart people, it makes you smarter too sometimes. Or if you hang out with really creative people, it sometimes even makes you more creative too. So you can consider that. And also, here's another thing. They offer classes. So if you want to learn how to become a potter, you want to, you know, throw pots too with everybody else, you could head on down there and check that out and take some of the classes down at the Mud Studio. So head on down there soon. It is right next door to Red Hen Cafe and Bakery, right off of Interstate 89, Exit 9, and, of course, that is in Middlesex. We'll take a short break. We'll be back right after these important announcements.
At the Honda Dream Garage sales event, we've got great deals on almost everything we make. Are you the sporty type into neatly manicured lawns? How about the snazzy Civic with rear view camera standard? And this handy lawnmower?
Eat this, dandelion!
All terrain on the brain? Road trip in a stylish Accord on Saturday and off-road in a Honda side-by-side.
Woo-hoo!
And for you amphibious types? Conquer both land and sea in a new Pilot and a fancy four-stroke marine engine for your aquatic vessel.
Yarr!
Whatever you're into, the Honda Dream Garage sales event has got great deals for just about everything. Now go! You've got a garage to fill, and we've got more innovations to unleash.
During the Dream Garage sales event, get 0.9% APR financing for well-qualified buyers on a 2015 Civic, Accord, and Pilot.
Visit your local North Country Honda dealer or online at northcountryhondadealers.com.
See your local dealer for financing details.
Paid for by the American Beverage Association, a member of Stop the Vermont Beverage Tax.
I'm Pam Tregg, and my husband Guy and I own Quality Market here in Barrie, Vermont. I joined Stop the Vermont Beverage Tax. You should too. This is a real mom and pop store. As a small business, we feel the burden of a lot of the regulations that we're required to comply with. And we face an inordinate number of taxes.
My name is Lindsay Curley, and I am the co-owner of Curley Corporation in Montpelier. Our store is very small. We have a 900 square foot convenience store. As a business owner, I appreciate our loyal customers, and the last thing I want to do is increase their costs when they come to our counter. As a mother, I know my price at the grocery store will increase, and I'm already trying to keep us within our budget. I believe people make good choices based on education and information, not on taxes. Join us at NoVermontBeverageTax.com.
I love Hunger Mountain Co-op because of the organic and high-quality food I get there. I'm Fred Chayette from Orange, Vermont, and I've been a member owner of Hunger Mountain Co-op since 1982.
We're back broadcasting live this morning. We're here at the Colby Military Writers Symposium. And let's give a nice Home Radio Vermont welcome this morning to Sherry Caddy, who's a alumna here and is an expert on cybersecurity and is working for the National Security Council. So do you hang out with Obama at the White House? You met him?
As my boss at the White House likes to say, the good news is the president is personally interested in cybersecurity. The bad news is
the president is personally
interested in cybersecurity. So there is quite a bit of work for us to do. But it's, you know, I'm pleased to say, obviously, this is a major issue of national concern, both for our national security and our economic security. And the president is very much personally interested. We've had a lot of activity in this space, which hopefully folks have noticed in the past several months, in particular since we had the issue with the North Korea attack on Sony Pictures Entertainment.
Right.
We've issued quite a number of executive orders on sanctioning bad behavior. Just last week, the president issued another executive order authorizing sanctions against foreign malicious behavior emanating from overseas folks. So it's just another tool in the toolbox that we're providing for the president and senior decision makers to be able to use to take action against malicious behavior in cyberspace. So it's a complex issue and not easily solved, but we're developing the tools to help the president do that.
When the North Korean thing happened, were you surprised by it?
Surprised that it happened? No. Surprised at the I think surprised at the reaction, because, you know, from a technology point of view, what they did was not that exciting. I mean, you know, bad actors are trying to get into systems every day, all day. Statistics out there, something on the order of, you know, the Department of Defense's networks are attacked a million times a day. So the fact that bad actors, even nation state bad actors, are doing bad things, that's kind of nothing new from the technologist point of view. I think, though, what was different about what happened this past fall was that a line was crossed here. It wasn't simply the nature of the what was done, the impact. It was that we had, you know, bad actor actually trying to impinge free speech, which is, of course, a deeply held principle for the United States, for this country. And a line was crossed. And so there was a decision to take action because we really can't have bad actors threatening our way of life, of threatening the free speech, the ability of anyone, whether it's actors in Hollywood or anyone else who wants to talk about, wants to express themselves, feeling constrained in doing so, that they're going to be attacked.
Okay. But help me, you say there's a line. Where's the line here? If we're, you know, I mean, if we're going around, I mean, we're scooping up all sorts of information on people. Maybe we're not making it public, but we're doing stuff that's equally
I think cyberspace is a very new environment, and there aren't bright lines. I think that's the challenge, right? It's certainly, if we talk about bright lines in terms of laws, you know, laws tend to catch up with technology. Technology moves a lot faster than our laws, than our public policy, and that's kind of the challenge. That the capability to do all kinds of things in cyberspace is growing at much more rapid pace than the rules of that behavior, if you want to think about it that way collectively. So, and I think we all enjoy the capabilities. We are building more and more things that are connected to the internet, what some people call the Internet of Things. So we all have now thermostats that you can take your mobile device and control the temperature in your house remotely. Yep. Or lock your doors of your house remotely. You know, we're looking at developing enabled cars that are going to be hooked to the internet and communicate. But as we hook more and more things up to the internet and we enjoy the capabilities of being able to do all of these things in a connected way online, but we have to look at how we're securing them. And then also, what are the rules around all of the information that's being collected? Because as you do things in your home with a connected thermostat, or move around in your car, or even, you know, take your mobile device and you're moving around with your mobile device, you know, information is being collected about where you are and often what you're doing and who has that information, who retains it, who looks at it, who controls it. These are areas that are, you know, we're still talking about emerging areas of public policy. So it's not simply a you know, federal government collecting a lot of information. The private sector is collecting a lot of information, right, on everyone. And we haven't caught up yet with the rules around what happens to that information. That's going to be a very long and rich public policy discussion going forward.
Talking with Sherry Caddy, she's the Director for Cybersecurity Policy Integration and Outreach for the National Security Council at the White House. Could you get into my computer?
Me personally, I am not that deep of a technologist.
Okay, could the people that work for you get into my computer?
Well, let me be clear. At the White House, we do policy. We don't necessarily do operational hacking, if you will.
All right.
But
could your operational hackers get into my computer?
I think just about anyone with the right skill set, regardless of who they work for, could get into your computer. You know, there is no such thing as a fully secured computer. There's no such thing as no risk, only managed risks. And so we know it's kind of axiomatic these days in cybersecurity that there are two types of organizations: those who know they've been hacked and those who don't know they've been hacked. The point being that you know, most systems are not, there's, you know, while you can harden your defenses and spend a lot of time and money doing that, there's no way to have a completely fully defended, impenetrable network. You will always have vulnerabilities. We're constantly finding things called zero days, new vulnerabilities in software that may have been written a decade ago.
Wow.
And then somebody just discovered that, oops, there was a little security hole in there and somebody discovered it and then they exploit it.
Okay.
So there's no such thing as complete security, and a determined adversary can find their way into just about any computer, even if they're whether they're exploiting software or network security flaws, or more likely they're targeting what is the biggest security flaw, which is the human operator. And so that's why you see 80 to 90% of system breaches are coming from phishing attacks, through getting users, unwitting users, to click on a bad link or a bad attachment through an email that then installs malicious software on your system and enables an actor to gain control of your system. So there's so many different vectors of exploit. You can't 100% protect against all of them. So it's about managing the risk.
How did you go from international studies to cybersecurity?
That's a good question. I would say that first and foremost, cybersecurity is such a ubiquitous part of our lives these days. We live our lives digitally online these days, and it impacts everything. It impacts every single industry, every single function, increasingly so. And it's a huge part of our diplomatic relationship now. We have quite a number of talks in our foreign relations with things like establishing norms of behavior in cyberspace, or differing views of privacy, and helping our foreign partners, helping everyone globally develop the capabilities to do computer incident response and share cyber threat and incident information broadly with everyone to help all of us protect ourselves better. So it's a big part of our diplomatic relationship. So my degrees are in foreign policy, and I spent the first number of years of my federal career working for the Foreign Service. And I came to work on helping secure our communications with our embassies overseas,
okay.
And help manage information for our embassy, you know, with our all of our networked, globally dispersed locations. And you know, if you're going to develop the means of sharing broadly across a globally dispersed network, at the same time you have to develop the appropriate means of securing that information.
I'll say. So
I developed a practice in security, and then gradually came to work for the intelligence community in post 9/11 in looking at how we can better share information amongst the different elements of the intelligence community to counter the counterterrorism threat. As we all know, post 9/11, the need was to make sure that the CIA was talking to the FBI so they could connect the dots and find the bad guys. And so
kind of like the different railroads needed to all find the same gauges of track.
Exactly. So a lot of the work that we've been doing is looking at how we can develop common standards for data, how we can develop interoperability amongst different standards so that the information is appropriately in a common way tagged, and that the users are and what they can see and what they can do with information is appropriately scoped, so that those two things can match up, and we get to that place where the right people have access to the right information. And we don't have broad access to
for everybody.
And and it's a challenging thing to do, particularly because the volume of information that we've been creating, the volume of networks and everything that's connected to networks is growing exponentially. And so, you know, how to make sure that all of those people, all of those devices, all of that information is adhering to a common standard that enables secure interoperable sharing is a huge and ongoing challenge. So, you know, I sort
does
of
it
evolved.
Change, does it change by the day, the week, the month, the year, or what?
Oh, by the day.
Really?
Of course.
Wow.
I mean, we're generating so much information, and not just information in the form of a user, you know, typing an email, but information in terms of sensors deployed across the network. So if you think about your mobile device, your home thermostat, even your connected to the internet coffee pot is a sensor, and that that sensor on the network is generating and collecting data.
Wow. All right. Answer me this question. The biggest cybersecurity threat to the country is what? Facebook.
No, I'm not going to say that. I think, at least from our perspective.
Or can't you tell me?
No, it's not that. I think because cybersecurity, again, is so ubiquitous and impacts every single industry and every single user, because we all have those convenient little mobile devices. Most people now in this country have more than one. They have a mobile cell phone. They have a you know, a computer, a tablet, all these different devices. And then, you know, you have all these other things like your car that could be connected to the internet. You know, so everybody has different, you know, based on who they are and what they're doing, they have different concerns because cyber is so ubiquitous. I think from a national perspective, the thing that we're most concerned about is making sure that we're securing our critical infrastructure so that we're taking the steps to make sure that the power grid, the water supply, and those systems, which now are all connected to the internet, you know, a lot of our industrial control systems that were built, you know, 20 or 30 years ago were built before the web, and they weren't necessarily designed to be connected to the web, but you know, they have been, and you know, they're still controlling these major systems, but you know, we're concerned to make sure that they're all operating in a secure way, and that's a, you know, that's a definitely a priority effort for us. So I'd say that's our main thrust, we've taken a lot of different actions in this regard in the last couple of years. But you know, we want to make sure that the major systems that we need to operate, everybody needs to operate on a daily basis, are secure. And the challenge is that most of what we consider to be critical infrastructure is not owned or operated by the government.
Right.
The water systems, the power systems, the financial services systems that we all depend on, these are operated by the private sector. And so it's an ongoing discussion with the private sector about the steps that they can take, what can we help with, what can they do to make sure that the infrastructure is secure for everybody.
How difficult would it be for a foreign government to, say, turn off the water supply somewhere?
I think we're still at the point where it's really difficult to take a specific action at a specific time. Most of the cyber exploits that we see are what we would call targets of opportunities, that bad actors are scanning networks and finding security flaws.
Okay.
And they're looking for systems that aren't properly protected or connected to the web, that aren't properly protected, and it's a target of opportunity. And so we still think it's really difficult for a specific actor to take a specific action at a specific time and place of their choosing. But that capability is maturing. But I think we're still looking at targets of opportunity as being the construct.
You know, this sounds like a little bit of a cat and mouse game. I'm sort of thinking radar, and then people get radar detectors, and then the radar gets better by the police. I mean, I guess in the balance here, who's winning, the security experts or the bad actors?
Well, I think that the economics, you know, still favor the attacker in cyberspace, that, you know, because scanning networks and targeting systems with malware, the same old malware can be used, you know, millions and millions of times. And if it succeeds just once or twice, then it's a positive return on investment for the attacker. So the economics still favor the attacker in cyberspace. And, you know, so we're trying to look at ways that we can try to make cyberspace inherently more secure, that you have to opt out of security. You take steps to opt out of security versus having to take steps to opt into security. So that's a key area that we're looking forward trying to change that dynamic.
Mm-hmm. And you're confident that the communications that, say, go between a guy like John Kerry and the White House, totally secure?
Well, as I said before, there's no system that's 100% secure. Obviously, for our most sensitive and priority communications, we take every step that we can to make sure that those are secure. But no one with any knowledge of the technology and the industry will ever tell you that there's anything that's 100% secure.
Have you ever gotten an indication that any of those kind of communications have been intercepted?
I can say that our systems, you know, various U.S. government systems are always an attractive target of attack. They're under attack every day, and we take steps to mitigate those when we see them.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything you do in your personal life you could share with us to make yourself more secure on the internet?
People do ask me all the time, okay, what do I do?
Yeah,
because it seems so very overwhelming.
Yeah.
Especially if you're not, you know, don't consider yourself a technology savvy person. And I think that the number one, you know, there's a couple of things that you can do. Certainly, we all have various devices and systems that we log into, and we're still at the place where we're using usernames and passwords. Not very good security, but it's still fairly ubiquitous. The number one thing people can do is do not use the same password in multiple places. Do not use simple, easily guessable passwords. Now, this is hard because it creates more burden and inconvenience for the user, and we're working on how can we do better things to make it easier to do security beyond just passwords, things like biometrics. You'll see more devices you know, taking thumbprints and things like that. But don't use the same password. Don't use it across multiple things. Change your passwords frequently. Don't give out all of your personal information.
Thank you for your time. That's going to wrap it up for today. FM 96.1 WDEV Warren, AM 550 WDEV Waterbury Montpelier News right now.
AP Radio News. I'm Rita Foley. The FBI...